This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. 4 years ago, Harper Lee's Go Set a Watchman created a stir when it emerged. And now another one of her unpublished works comes to light. This one came from a period just after she published To Kill a Mockingbird. It was a true crime project tracing the dramatic trial of Reverend Willie Maxwell, a man accused of killing his family for insurance money. Investigative journalist Casey Sepp reopened the murder case and retraced Harper Lee's footsteps through a small Alabama town. She interviewed many of the same local contacts that Lee established. Her new book is called Furious Hours, Murder, Fraud, and the Last Trial of Harper Lee. And it revisits the 1970s courtroom drama while weaving in Harper Lee's personal struggles. Author Casey Sepp joins me in the studio now. Welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me.
This is an incredible project because it takes in so many aspects of this wild story, Harper Lee's story herself, the particular murder trial, the murder that followed. Tell us how you got involved in all of this.
Sure. So you mentioned in 2015 there was this shocking announcement that Harper Lee, who for years had said she was never going to publish another book, up and announced she was publishing another book, Go Set a Watchman. And I went down for The New Yorker, you know, a lot of journalists did, to try and figure out what was going on and, you know, look into the provenance of that manuscript and her ability to consent to its publication. And so I wrote an article for The New Yorker about that. But while I was down there, I learned about this other book that she had tried to write in the 1970s and 80s and that had really caught her attention. And it was every bit as fascinating as the story of Mockingbird, you know, the story of Maycomb. And so I got very interested, and I love Harper Lee's work, so the chance to learn more about her life was just too tantalizing to pass up.
So tell us the story. Tell us the murder trial that intrigued her in the first place.
Yeah, so the truth is she loved true crime. You know, she and her sisters as kids followed, you know, her older sister loved the Leopold and Loeb case, and they read Sherlock Holmes, and they loved detective stories. So they followed a lot of crime stories, but this one started in 1970, and it was a Baptist minister accused of killing his wife. And he wasn't convicted of that murder, but folks thought for sure he was guilty of it. And sure enough, a second wife turned up dead under similarly suspicious circumstances, a brother, a nephew, and then a stepdaughter. So five relatives over a period of 7 years, and he held life insurance policies on all of them. So folks were pretty sure that he was involved. And Harper Lee got involved, though, in 1977, after that last victim was a 16-year-old stepdaughter. And at her funeral, the reverend was gunned down by a vigilante. And that's when Harper Lee found out about the case in the summer of 77, after that vigilante murdered the reverend in front of 300 people. And she came to town that fall when the vigilante's trial started. And she moved to town and spent about 9 months knocking on doors, gathering documents, doing all the same work that I did for my book, and actually that she had helped Capote do many years before for In Cold Blood.
Yeah, so you've opened up about 1,000 wonderful trunks that we need to riffle through, but let's stick with this spending about 9 months in that community. This is for the trial of the man who killed the murderer of seven family members, so it gets a bit complicated. But she's going to sit through, and she's going to get to know the town. And here is where the paradox of Harper Lee's public persona comes into play. We know her, if we know her at all, as someone who is reclusive, who didn't like to talk, certainly to the media, and didn't seem to be a terribly friendly or outgoing person.
Yeah, I mean, certainly that was kind of the misconception I had of Harper Lee, too. And, you know, it turns out just because you don't want to talk to the New York Times doesn't mean you don't want to talk to anyone. And, you know, to say that you don't want to talk to the media does not mean you're antisocial. And so Harper Lee, when she came to this community, really just charmed people. And, you know, she would spend hours with some of these sources, and she went to cocktail parties, and, you know, she met strangers in the grocery store, at the veterinarian's office, and she just made her way around town and made such a positive impression on everyone there. And again, it parallels what she had done in Kansas, because the folks who were, you know, friends of the Clutters, who lived through the Clutter murders, had not really wanted to talk to Truman Capote. They found him odd and off-putting and insensitive, and they felt Harper Lee was warm and empathetic, and they wanted to talk to her about what had happened. And so here again, you know, in this tiny town in Alabama, she did the same thing. And I think it was, for me, one of the most surprising aspects of the book was just learning about the kind of person she was in the world. And she was witty and charming, and folks said it was like talking to a, you know, living encyclopedia. She could just talk for hours about any topic. So it was really wonderful.
This may point to some of the conflict because we know from some of her correspondence that she was unhappy with Truman Capote and with In Cold Blood and some of the way that that came out. She'd done some of the research. She knew the story. And she wasn't particularly happy with the way it was represented in the novel.
Yeah, there's been a lot of good scholarship on In Cold Blood lately. And, you know, the truth is it's a beautiful book, but it's a troubled book. And for so long, it's been taught as a kind of canonical text of nonfiction. And I think Harper Lee knew right away what some of us have been slow to learn, which is that, you know, there are scenes that are massaged or exaggerated and truths that are extended. And she was pretty old-fashioned and thought, you know, there was nonfiction and there was fiction and there was a wide gulf between the two. And she really didn't like her friend Truman Capote going around calling his work a nonfiction novel, which seemed to her to be a contradiction in terms. So it's quite interesting. You know, that friendship is interesting to think about in Harper Lee's life, but their work on In Cold Blood certainly relates to her work on this case.
Which brings me to this question. What do you think she was trying to accomplish with this book that she didn't ultimately did not publish?
Yeah, so she never published it. So, you know, we're in the realm of speculation, except she did obviously articulate to folks in this town what she was doing and her ambitions for the book she was working on. And she was very clear that she wanted to write a nonfiction book and that she was, you know, doing old-fashioned, straight-laced journalism, as she said, and she only wanted the facts. And, you know, the truth of the matter is that's kind of hard no matter the story you're reporting. But it was particularly hard in this case because it had been a sensational one and there was a lot of fear and rumor and gossip around it. So she really had her work cut out for her. You know, you could have found a more straightforward series of murders to investigate if that were your ambition. Then it's easy to see, despite her charms and energy and, you know, enthusiasm as a reporter, why she was stymied when she did sit down and try and turn it into a book.
And what we've yet to mention is the fact that the Baptist minister who is accused of killing 7 family members and ultimately murdered himself is African-American.
Yeah, so I think that to me is one of the most, you know, interesting things about her interest in this case. So here was the writer of To Kill a Mockingbird who for years had been heralded as a champion of the civil rights movement and who had inspired, you know, and continues to inspire countless attorneys to go into civil rights careers or to take up areas of the law that champion the underserved and those who lack for representation. And yet she herself was pretty silent on the issue of civil rights. And she didn't march. She didn't protest. She rarely spoke publicly about anything political. And yet here she was in 1977, determined to write a book about, you know, a black man accused of murder who was never convicted. Black-on-black crime, which is itself an interesting problem to write about because you want to represent it carefully and responsibly and not in a sensational way. And more to the point, here was Harper Lee, you know, a fairly affluent white woman walking into an African-American community in one of the most rural counties in Alabama, Coosa County, trying to get to know these folks' lives and trying to learn about the dynamics of their community. So it's ambitious and interesting, but again, I think that's one of the things that ultimately made the project difficult for her. And certainly other people who knew her at the time say that, you know, her publishers were not excited about this project. It was not the follow-up anyone expected from a woman who, you know, by some accounts had written a children's book, a book that was already ensconced in school curriculum and that was taught to, you know, adolescent readers. And, you know, this was going to be a very different, more scandalous book.
Can you tell from your research if she was as well received in African-American communities as she was in the white communities when she had to get information?
Yeah, I mean, that's not to say that she wasn't successful at doing it. I think, you know, one of the most interesting folks I got to talk to when I was working on the book is the vigilante. So the man who murdered the Reverend Maxwell is a man named Robert Louis Burns. And Harper Lee interviewed Robert twice, and he found her absolutely charming. And, you know, he, more than anyone, was sad she didn't write the book because he couldn't believe that the author of To Kill a Mockingbird was interested in his story. And she came to his home twice and, you know, spent time with him and learned about his life before that murder and learned about his service in Vietnam and seemed to really be digging into a complex portrait of him. And so, yeah, she seems to have been well received there. And, you know, we know that she talked with relatives of the victims, all of whom were black, and she talked to them about, you know, their dead loved ones and about the experience of living through that. And so she managed to find inroads in every community.
Which brings us to another fascinating detail in this story, the fact that you can talk so confidently about a man who is acquitted as the killer. Everybody knew it. Everybody saw it. He was acquitted, His attorney, I mean, talk about who defended him.
Sure, yeah. I mean, the problem with this case, and God bless Harper Lee, she knew a good story when she found one, it's extremely complicated. And one of the complications is that the Reverend for about 10 years had the same attorney, and that was a man named Tom Radney. And Tom, you know, defended him in all of those criminal investigations, but he also did a lot of civil litigation on his behalf because the insurance companies obviously at a certain point did not want to continue to pay out policies to the Reverend Maxwell. So he did a lot of lawyering for the Reverend. He then also defended Robert Burns, the man who murdered his former client. And, you know, Tom Radney, you know, there was a whole other series of, you know, rumors and gossip about him and about his work for the Reverend. And folks were shocked when he took the case of the vigilante. And, you know, Harper Lee spent time getting to know him, too. And it was just another complication to the case.
On the other hand, this is the lawyer's lawyer. This is the guy who'll take every case and do it with conscientiously through it. So it is the follow-up in some ways, if you choose to follow that thread in a very complicated story.
Yeah, you know, Harper Lee loved good stories, and she loved lawyers. You know, her father was a lawyer, her sister was a lawyer. She was a law school dropout. She spent a lot of time thinking about lawyering. And so, right, she found a very interesting one in Alexander City. And we haven't mentioned that Tom Radney had a political career before he settled into small town law. So I think there again, she found a case that was going to let her write about a lot of different things.
Right.
And to really advance the plot, because, you know, Mockingbird, the novel she had put into the world, was set during the Great Depression. You know, it was published in the 60s, but it took place in the 1930s. And so here was a writer who wanted to write about contemporary life, but had kind of been denied the privilege of doing so. So she found this case that was really going to drag her forward into the present day. And she was going to have to write about race in the era after the Civil Rights Movement and write about the complexities of the criminal justice system in contemporary life, not in a historic way.
Yeah, so this was her chance. What happened?
Million-dollar question. What happened? You know, I talk a lot in Furious Hours about all the things that made it hard for Harper Lee to write at all. So not just this book, but other projects that she started in the years after Mockingbird. And, you know, some of those are very straightforward. There are things that plague a lot of writers. She suffered from depression. She had a drinking problem. She was a little bit of a perfectionist, so she suffered from writer's block. And so those were all of the things that made any project hard. But there's an added layer of complexity to this case. And, you know, she had not published a nonfiction book before, so she had set herself to this other genre and this other task. And we were talking about how complex this case is. And, you know, I think that the temptation would be to think you walk into a story with heroes and villains and a ready plot, and it's messy and it's complicated and the characters are very human, and all of that was challenging for her. And so we know that there are some particular things she struggled with this case.
And you point out that the support network that she had to get her through Mockingbird had by then disintegrated.
Yeah, I think, you know, when we talk about Go Set a Watchman and To Kill a Mockingbird, it's tricky because it seems like Go Set a Watchman is the sequel in the sense that the characters are aged up. You know, Scout is a young woman, Atticus is an older man. But she wrote that first. So that was a draft of Mockingbird she wrote in 1957. And she had been aided in her effort to revise that manuscript by both a loving agent, a guy named Maurice Crane, and a very talented editor, a woman named Tay Hohoff. And when I say talented, you know, she's up there with Maxwell Perkins, you know, who helped Thomas Wolfe and Hemingway and Fitzgerald bring great books into the world. This was an editor who, you know, read Go Set a Watchman and said, I don't want to publish this, but I like this world and I like these characters and let's figure out a way to make a story out of them. And so, you know, it was a 2.5-year revision process. It was very extensive. And by the time she was working on the Maxwell case, Harper Lee had lost both of those folks. You know, she no longer had that editor. That editor had died. That agent had died. And she never replaced that editorial infrastructure. So she didn't have many people to talk to about her work. And, you know, she did not have people to keep her on task. So I think, you know, despite being energized by the reporting and, you know, despite having 9 months of just serious productivity when she was in town, she then went home to New York to face the blank page.
You talk about being a big fan and an early fan early in your life of To Kill a Mockingbird and, you know, loved her work, loved that book, identified closely with Scout. What was it like for you now to be reporting on?
Gosh, I mean, a little bit of a dream come true. Yeah. You know, it's hard to imagine when you're a kid you'll get to grow up and write a book about a book you so love. And so it was really a pleasure to get to learn more about her life and to talk to family and friends of hers who just had this intimate portrait of her. And it was not the one that I had kind of gotten from the earlier kind of biographical portraits. And it was really interesting. And, you know, I did love Mockingbird, but I think in some ways I had underestimated her. And one thing that was just over and over again remarkable to me was, first of all, her just ambition. You know, this project and several others, she just had an appetite. And just because she didn't finish the books or didn't publish them doesn't mean that she wasn't trying to do ambitious work. And so that was one surprise. And the other was just, you know, I think I thought of her as kind of a small town gal, but of course she lived most of her adult life in New York and she was extremely cosmopolitan. So it was totally fun, the reporting I did in New York, to just find out, you know, all the museums and restaurants where she hung out. And, you know, she was not associating with the literati, but she was, you know, haunting the same joints in New York that they were. So that was just really fun. On the other hand, you know, I do love Harper Lee, and I think as much as anyone can, I was rooting for her. And so parts of the reporting were sad because you just watched a writer you admired who, you know, you wanted nothing more than to find out she had written 10 secret books that we didn't know about, mm-hmm. but instead found, you know, real suffering and dysfunction and struggles. And that was sad and that was hard to sit with, and gives the last third of the book a little bit of a melancholic tone because it's someone, again, who I was just hoping every day to find the manuscript that would prove she had been, you know, more successful than we thought, and it never materialized.
Is there enough there that she did produce that, you know, in the hands of a savvy and sensitive set of editors could be turned into a book?
Gosh, that's a great question. And, you know, I think one way of answering it is to kind of think about the books we'll get to read from Harper Lee in the future. And one we'll almost certainly get to read is a collected letters collection. Mm-hmm. And I got to read hundreds of her letters when I was working on this book. And she was such a stylist, and there's such a delight to read. And, you know, I think we'll have that book, and it'll be a real treasure. And maybe the collected nonfiction, because she wrote some shorter things over the years. But I don't think in the case of this true crime book, you know, there's ever going to be something between two covers called The Reverend that tells the Reverend Maxwell story.
Well, we do have Casey Sepp's book. It is called Furious Hours, Murder, Fraud, and the Last Trial of Harper Lee. Casey Sepp is the author and is going to be talking at Country Bookshop in Southern Pines today at 5. Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill tomorrow at 7. You can find out everything at our website, stateofthings.org. Casey, thank you so much. What a pleasure.
An honor to be here. Thanks.
You can find out everything at our website, stateofthings.org. I guarantee it. Film adaptations of The Wizard of Oz. You saw it. You loved it. Maybe you hated it. Tell us your experience with The Wizard of Oz for the next Movies on the Radio, SOT@WUNC.org. And you can be on the show, #SOTMovie. We want to know your experience with The Wizard of Oz coming up on the big anniversary. This is the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.